hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Voter turnout in America is usually quite low. About 66% of the electorate cast ballots in 2020, and that was considered high. But that means that one-third of the electorate didn't vote. In the 2022 midterms, about 46% of voters cast a ballot, which was down from the previous midterm election of 2018, which had a turnout of 49%, the highest since 1914. People celebrated the historic engagement, but I kept thinking, why are we celebrating when only half of the electorate showed up? What about an even bolder idea? Could we adopt compulsory voting like they have in Australia, Belgium, and several places in South America and Latin America? To discuss that issue, I'm pleased to welcome E.J. Dionne to Democracy Optimist. He's the co-author of a book with Miles Rappaport called 100% Democracy, The Case for Universal Voting, which calls for America to adopt a system where everyone is required to vote. Full disclosure, I helped EJ and Miles with the chapter on whether the plan is constitutional. EJ is also a regular columnist for The Washington Post and is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. His best-selling book, Why Americans Hate Politics, was called a classic in American political history by Newsday and became a National Book Award nominee. EJ, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Well, three things. First, it's a real joy to be with you. Second, everybody out there, I'm sure you're too humble to plug your book. You probably never plugged your book on this podcast, but people should know, check it out. It's a really important book. I've read it. And it really is a great look at how the court has dealt with voting issues over a long period of time in an utterly accessible way. It's good when law professors write in accessible ways. Second, thank you for the work you did with Miles and me on this idea. We put together, Miles and I, a working group that really kind of tried to test this idea with academics, with election officials, people who run elections, with voting rights advocates, with opponents of the idea. We wanted to sort of stress test it a bit. And we were really grateful for the time you put in. And third, I'm going to begin with hope and then get to our idea, because it is, you're entirely right that, 66% is sort of a C or a D by most measures. We ought to be able to do better than that, which is why we wrote 100% Democracy. But that huge turnout in 2020 showed us that voters actually are responsive when the country makes it easier for people to vote. Yes, the stakes between Joe Biden and Donald Trump were very high, and that certainly had something to do with the turnout. But we were holding an election in the middle of a pandemic where, when the election year started, we wondered, how in the world are we going to make this work? People may value their democratic rights, small d, but they don't want to give themselves COVID by going to vote. And lo and behold, all over the country, across party lines, election officials, in some cases legislators, put all these new ways of voting in place, and people responded by voting. I always say I was very proud to cast my ballot in a drop box in front of Walt Whitman High School in Bethesda, Maryland. I was happy to do that for two reasons. One is my kids went to Whitman, a great public high school, but two, Walt Whitman is the poet of American democracy. So I thought it was a poetic act as I dropped my ballot in the box. But you're right, we can do better. And that's why Miles and I came together around this idea. I really first became familiar with what the Australians call compulsory attendance at the polls. That's important because you don't have to mark your ballot for anybody. You just have to participate.
None of the bums is you can write.
Yeah, right. Or you can write, you can draw Mickey Mouse's face on your ballot. You can do anything you want with your ballot. You just have to participate. And I started going there in the 90s. And this system has been in place for close to 100 years, And it's really worked. And it's accompanied by ways of making it easy as possible for people to vote, which we need to do. And also with government making sure, making it easy and helping people to register. The result in Australia in a whole bunch of elections recently, roughly 96% are registered and 90% of them vote. And election day, which they hold on a Saturday, is almost like a national party. And you show up at the polls and all kinds of community groups are out there selling great stuff to eat, to raise money for their cause. And that is so embedded that there are now websites in Australia that rate the food at different polling places. And if you...
The sausage sizzle, right? The democracy sausage.
Yeah, the sausage sizzle. And in our book, we are pro-democracy sausage, but we also call for vegan alternatives. but, you know, you can look at a website and see what kind of food you want and how is it rated. And you can vote anywhere in your state. You can pick a polling place that matches your food. That's kind of fun to talk about, but it also is a way to embed elections into the civic life of the country. And so I'll be glad to talk about the specifics of our proposal, why we call it universal instead of compulsory.
Yeah, that was my next question. You know, the book is called 100% Democracy, The Case for Universal Voting. That's an interesting phrase. Why did you use that?
Well, we used it partly inspired by ideas for universal service, which call for everyone at some point in their life to give service to the country, but also because we are trying to adapt essentially the Australian system. You're quite right, about two dozen countries at various moments, over 20 now have versions of this system. The Australian system is particularly well articulated and I think fits well with us, but we tried to adapt it to American views and, you know, the American situation. One thing we've always had when we had a draft in the United States was conscientious objection. And so if for some reason someone believes that they just do not want to vote, there are religious groups that are reluctant to vote, for example, but you don't need a religious reason, you could apply for conscientious objector status and it would be very liberally granted. And so that's why we call it universal instead of compulsory. You can really, really, really get out of it if you want to. Secondly, something we are very careful about is we don't want this to become a criminal matter. What this proposal is a nudge, not a shove. The fine that we propose, it's 20 Australian. Last I checked, that was about $15 American. We suggest a $20 fine that is not criminal, that can't be raised by interest or anything else. We don't want to create a Ferguson problem where lower income people are sort of piled on with fines that grow over time. You could get out of the fine with an hour of community service. And as in Australia, if you don't vote, you get a notice from the government. And if you give any plausible reason for why you couldn't get to the polls, people are let off the fine. And so I think the numbers are that only about 15% of the people who don't vote end up having to pay it. But it's just a nudge. It says, in a democracy, it is both a right and an obligation for everyone to participate. And lastly, one of our main motives here is to really change the incentives for people who enact and rule on in court and election laws and run elections. That if it is a civic duty for everyone to vote, then our system has to shift its emphasis on making it as simple as possible for every citizen to carry out his or her civic duty. And so we have a whole bunch of what we call gateway reforms, which are mostly familiar, about easy early voting and automatic registration, all kinds of ways. So it's not a huge burden to vote, so you can carry out your civic duty.
So you mentioned already this concern about minority voters and not wanting to saddle particular, you know, have an increasing interest on a fine. There's obviously a sorry history in our country of racial discrimination in voting. And so I suspect that minority groups might be skeptical of, look, if you don't show up, the government's going to fine you. How do you address that? And I know, you know, we had the working group that discussed these proposals that then led to your and Miles's book. How do you address that concern of the racial inequities in society and how that would play out with a concept of universal voting?
Right. We vetted this, and that was an issue that we were very concerned about. A related issue that we think you need to be very careful about are immigrants who might end up inadvertently on the rolls, but don't actually yet have the right to vote, who may not have gotten citizenship. And we don't want them caught in a double bind where they're fined if they don't vote and they are subject to criminal prosecution if they do. We met with lots of different groups, including immigrant groups, particularly Latino groups, who are a big chunk of our immigrant population, and civil rights groups. What we found that was interesting is that civil rights groups like the NAACP and others were more sympathetic to our idea than almost anyone else, because they understood that while this fine issue is real and we had to deal with it, which we tried to do in the way we structured with the proposal, discrimination against Black Americans in our voting history is an even bigger problem. And that they were very sympathetic to this idea because they agreed with us, or we agreed with them, that what you really need is pressure to end discrimination, end efforts to make it harder for Black people to vote, for poor people to vote, by just a little rigging of election laws at the side with voter IDs that not everybody can get easily and so on. And so we think that on net, with the protections we offer, this is actually a net plus for Black Americans and other excluded groups. And by the way, it's good for white working class Americans, many of whom are voting Republican these days, and are also underrepresented in the electorate. So one of the things we insist on, and we have a whole analysis in the book, is that, you know, a lot of people would say, well, the two of you are progressive, you're trying to rig elections for Democrats. Actually, we show some good evidence in the book. It's not at all clear that this rigs elections for Democrats or Republicans. We're interested in the broadest possible participation in our election, and we're willing to live with the outcome.
So I think back to the debate over Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which was seen as trying to get universal health care for Americans. And a lot of people who opposed likened it to the government requiring them to eat broccoli. And who's the government, the federal government, to come and tell me I need to eat broccoli and be healthy and have health insurance? And, you know, a sizable number of Americans still don't have health insurance, even though it's easily accessible through Obamacare. Why do you think people would accept the government requirement of voting if we can't get them to get health care?
You know, Miles and I did about 40 events around this idea when the book came out, and this was one of the most common questions. Another way it was often put is, if Americans don't want to be required to get vaccinated to save their lives, how in the world will they ever accept an idea like this? And you could say that Miles and I are either the dumbest book writers ever or the most honest. Somebody said we could be both, because we have polling in the book that shows, as of right now, only 26% of Americans support our idea. But what our polling also showed is another roughly quarter of Americans were not strongly opposed and at least open in principle to persuasion. So we figure that we have a lot of persuading to do, but that for an idea that's never been advanced systematically in our country, we got about half the country that at least either half a quarter is for it, a quarter seems to be willing to listen to arguments. And in that polling, we really probed for why people are against the idea. And, you know, the strongest was just what you say, I shouldn't be required to vote, period. And, you know, the libertarian argument. All the other forms of opposition we could deal with easily, including making sure that people aren't fined if a jurisdiction is making it hard for people to vote, we would outlaw that. All jurisdictions would be required to make it easy for people to vote. You know, we try to deal with a libertarian argument to some degree with the conscientious objector proposal. But the other argument we make is there are many other things in American life that are compulsory. One of the biggest victories for civil rights was to end discrimination in jury selection. But what that meant, ending discrimination in jury selection meant that Black people, as well as white people, could be required to serve on juries. And we have compulsory jury duty because we want the broadest possible pool of people to be included in judging whether somebody goes to jail or not, or whether somebody is fined or not, or whether somebody wins or loses a civil case or not. We have parents who are required to educate their kids to age 16, either by sending them to school or by homeschooling them. But there's that requirement. You're required to pay your taxes. You can go to jail if you don't pay your taxes. So there are forms of compulsion. We believe this is a very minor form of compulsion compared to the benefit of having elections where everybody knows that basically everyone is going to participate, virtually everyone. And what does that mean in another way? One of the metaphors we've enjoyed using and talking about the book is how elections have become like a fancy dinner party where you've got an A-list of voters, you know, people who are registered to vote all the time. They get all the attention of the campaigns. You got a B-list of people who may be registered and don't vote much. They get some attention from a campaign. And then you get the C-list of some of unregistered. Sometimes campaigns will run voter registration drives, but they don't get much attention. Under our system, politicians would have to pay attention to every voter. They would have to be encouraging all of them to vote, because when you're asked to vote, when you're given information on the election, you tend to vote more. And we think this democratization, small d, of the election process is worth that piece of compulsion. But yes, we got a lot of persuading to do. And Miles has actually, as you know, set up an organization called 100% Democracy. And we're trying to see our idea adopted in cities where they have the authority, or states, to show that this system can work. It's how a lot of reforms bubble up in our democracy, and that's what we're hoping with this one.
Yeah, and your answers also, I think, get to what I was going to ask next, which is the constitutionality. But as you note, one, we already compel Americans to do various things. And two, we're not compelling speech here. This proposal is not compelling speech. It's compelling attendance at the polls, which, you know, as we already mentioned, I helped with the legal chapter with some other lawyers as well, and concluded that there's at least a good argument that this would not be compelled speech under the First Amendment. So are you seeing progress? You mentioned, you know, trying cities and states. Are you seeing some progress so far in places where they're holding hearings and talking about the idea?
I always tell people that one of my favorite chapters in the book is the constitutionality chapter, and that Miles and I wrote about 10 words of that chapter. That we had the best group of lawyers, including you, who really worked this issue and really went into great detail on past court cases. And I think that this point, before I answer that question, is really worth underlining, that you don't have to cast a ballot for anyone. And we would add, just to be clear on that, a none of the above option. We would encourage states to have that option. So you could either leave it blank, you could scrawl something on it, or you could check the none of the above box. Miles has had a lot of, has made some progress. There was a lot of interest in the legislature in Washington state, and I think it would be interesting to see if that's possible. One of my other favorite parts of the book is a model bill that was introduced in Connecticut by a former state senator called Will Haskell, who is a former student of mine. And we included the bill just to show this can be written. It went to committee. It didn't pass.
But there's at least conversations, you know, in these places doing it. We're almost out of time, I want to make sure we get to the last question that I ask all guests, which is, why should people vote? What's the point of voting, especially in a system where we don't have compulsory voting and, you know, you have the presidential election often coming down to swing states?
Just to finish that other point, John Larson, the congressman from Connecticut, has introduced it in the Congress. So it's there. We're hoping initially to get hearings and have people debate about it.
So it's also being discussed at the federal level, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So EJ, why should people vote?
You know, I was involved in a political campaign way back in the anti-war days, and we had the most heavy-handed voter registration ad I think anyone's ever run. And we had a picture of Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. And the slogan on top of it was, people who don't care enough to vote can always find somebody to do it for them. And I think that there are both negative and positive reasons to vote. The negative reasons is there are real threats out there to democracy. Government can do things that utterly violate your principles or can make certain problems worse. And at the very least, you would want to stop bad things from happening. But elections also can have positive consequences for people who support voting rights, to go to the theme of your show. The results of the 1964 election, when LBJ got reelected, were absolutely essential to the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which is one of the most important democratizing steps the country has ever taken. Elections determine who gets on the courts. If you're a student, you have some people disagree with this, may want to vote against it, but you have major efforts to reduce the debt load on students. There are many, many things positive that government can do. I'd point to another thing, which is there's been substantial action on climate. The point is that government is never perfect. Government almost never does every single thing every one of us wants. Each of us may disagree with each other on two issues, but agree on 10, and we can fight together for those issues. If you don't vote, your voice isn't heard. People say, we quote somebody in the book from who's a dual Australian-American citizen. And she said, I always objected to the idea of people saying, I'm not voting as a protest against the system. And she said, that's not an active protest. No one hears what you're saying. No one knows what you're doing. All you are is someone who doesn't participate. If you want to change things, participation is the first step for you to take. If you really hate the candidates, mainstream candidates, two-party candidates, you can vote for a third-party candidate. We are for, by the way, transferable voting, what Australians call preference voting, where we think you can number your candidates 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which allows everyone to have their ballot read the way they intended. And so we hope our system, and especially if you combine it with preference voting, would encourage absolutely everyone to vote and have their ballot read exactly as they intended. Seems to me that should be the goal of a democratic system. And judging from Australia and a lot of other countries, citizens like it, respond to it, and create a culture of participation.
E.J. Dion is the co-author of 100% Democracy, The Case for Universal Voting. He's a Washington Post columnist and, I might say, a democracy champion as well. E.J., thank you for joining Democracy Optimist.
Well, thanks to you, and thanks for all the work you do on this, because you are a democracy champion, too.
So, Josh, is voting mandatory in other countries?
Yeah, let's talk about how compulsory voting works in other places. And the most prominent example, as E.J. Dion told us, is Australia. It's one of about 20 countries around the world with mandatory or compulsory voting. It all began in Australia in 1915 when the state of Queensland, encompassing the northeastern coastline of Australia, became the first Australian jurisdiction to enact compulsory voting in its 1915 Queensland state election. It was a resounding success if you're talking about voter turnout, which increased by around 12%. And that ultimately inspired the federal government of Australia to adopt a similar policy, bringing compulsory voting nationwide in 1924. Australia had experienced a stark decline in turnout from the 1919 election to the 1922 election. It went from more than 71% in 1919 to less than 60% in 1922. In response, the Australian Parliament passed a bill in 1924 to amend the Electoral Act and make voting compulsory for all federal elections. The impact was immediate, with turnout in the 1925 election rising to over 91%. A 31% increase compared to 1922. Today, voting in Australia is compulsory at state and federal levels of government. After turning 18, every Australian citizen is required to cast a ballot, unless they are reasonably prevented from doing so. Ballot excuses include being impeded by sickness, natural events like weather, or accidents of any kind. They also include rare exceptions, such as where a person in transit to a polling booth was diverted in some way to save life, prevent a crime, or assist in an emergency. Those who don't vote and aren't able to provide a valid excuse will face monetary penalties. The Australian Election Commission will assess a $20 administrative penalty, though there are various ways to appeal that fine. A major part of compulsory voting is ensuring that voting is accessible to as many Australians as possible. Australia makes it relatively easy to cast a ballot, including by having its elections on a Saturday and offering guaranteed paid time off to vote for those who have to work. Election Day is like a party. The democracy sausage sizzle is famous. Perhaps the U.S. can learn something from our friends down under.
Josh, election night in America can be really chaotic. The networks race to call the winners, but those election night calls are just media projections. In reality, the election's not officially over and decided until weeks later when election officials certify the results, as they did on January 6, 2021. So how do they do election reporting in other countries?
So I recently spent some time in Italy as part of a Fulbright visit to Luiss University in Rome. And I learned some really interesting things there about how Italians run their elections. While I was there, I met with someone from the Italian Ministry of Elections to learn about their practices. I was amazed by their real-time election reporting system called Eligendo. Through this secure system, the public can learn official election results right away from a trusted government source. In America, an entity called the Decision Desk HQ is one of the leading providers of real-time election results on election night. It uses a programming device to obtain election results as soon as they are published by state and county election officials. They also use phone calls, faxes, and even in-person reporters to supplement the data. Of course, again, those results are not official until the election officials certify them. For the 2024 elections, Decision Desk HQ will base one of its only in-person operations at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy, of which E.J. Dion is a distinguished university professor. So students will have a chance to see in real time how election reporting works.
So how can we learn more about compulsory voting around the world?
There's two websites that I think have some great information. The first is International IDEA at idea.int. Search for compulsory voting. Another great website is 100%democracy.org. That's 100democracy.org, which is the site for an organization that stems from E.J. Dion and Miles Rappaport's book on the topic.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host. Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.